Michael Perouche, who is going to be talking about whistleblowers in tech. Ayana talking about artificial intelligence versus machine learning. And Bradley Marker is presenting digital tonight for digital ownership. Michael, would you like to start?
Sure. Hopefully you can see that.
Yep.
Cool. So my presentation, like she said, is over. Whistleblowers and some of the ethical concerns that we may come across since we're probably all going to work in tech at some point. The first thing I wanted to bring up was that the concerns aren't always immediately obvious, like in other industries, like, for example, factory farming, because obviously that one's pretty easy to see. On one hand, you're feeding a lot of people, but on the other hand, you're killing a bunch of animals that theoretically you don't have to if you wanted to go for a vegetarian option. Tech's a lot different. Ethical concerns a lot of the time get swept under the rug. People can watch, you know, thousands of hours of content in a year, and people don't see a problem with it because they put the onus on you as like, if you have a problem with it, your willpower should probably be more, it's a self-responsibility thing rather than a let's look at these companies that might be acting in bad faith sort of thing. So the two big ethical concerns that most people find themselves hearing about are user privacy and data hoarding that happens with these companies. Like Facebook, for instance, I've never used it, but if I signed up right now, they'd have a profile of me immediately and link me up to all my friends from high school or whatever to encourage me to keep using their platform. I do use Google for Google Maps and stuff like that. And unless you deliberately turn it off in their settings, even if you don't use the map to get somewhere, they track when you went there, what time you arrived, what time you left, and all that stuff, and keep a profile of it. Even if you didn't use their service to get there, they basically just take the data off your phone anyway, which I always thought was pretty creepy. And even more companies will sell your data. They just own it, and they'll sell it for a quarter or maybe 50 cents to a bunch of other companies. That's how you get all these people cold calling you out of nowhere. There are companies who make it their job literally just to know everything about you and sell it to pretty much the lowest bidder. A lot of the times they're selling it for not a lot of cash. The second ethical concern I see a lot are algorithms on websites that lock you into certain types of content that basically never change, which is how you get certain groups that believe things that are kind of nonsensical, like flat earthers and whatnot. They only see content that perpetuates those myths because the algorithms just want to keep them on the website for longer. And when you get people that have a problem with this in your organization, things might get done about it. For instance, Frances Haugen in 2021, this is not something I heard about very much, but she became a whistleblower after leaving Facebook and leaking a bunch of their internal documents. And this part I want to get clear to everybody because I thought this was crazy. Facebook, in their own documents, acknowledged that they knew they were having an effect of like an echo chamber on certain people, that users were using Facebook to promote violence in certain regions like civil wars, and were using it to further human trafficking, among other things. Facebook also, in their own documents, was focusing their attention to try and get more children to use the platform, even though they admitted in their own documentation that they thought it was hurting their mental health. And they also believed that they had a pretty big part to play in misinformation that spread that led to the January 6th riots. This is not something that she said. It is something that was in the documents themselves, which I thought was a pretty big, important thing to get across. I will go back for a second just to say, they didn't really address any of these concerns at the time. They basically just said she didn't work there for long enough and could not have known well enough of their internal operations, and that basically it was a hoax. But their own documents is what was saying this, not her. She went on to talk to the UK Parliament, the EU, and our own government. We'll get to that later. Another guy who I thought was important because of mainly the things that he said was Uber's Mark McGann. He was a silent whistleblower for a number of years and was slowly leaking information about how they would lobby governments, openly break laws. They would have concealment switches, so when police came, they could delete or hide their data. They would mislead police by giving police fake apps. The police would request a ride. The ride would never come. And I'm not really sure why they did that, but a lot of misleading of police and government entities Uber was doing from basically 2011 to like 2016. And the documents he was leaking were a few years after they were doing it. He obviously, and Francis Haugen also, felt a moral problem was they were seeing and wanted to do something about it. So they came forward and started leaking documents to try and enact a change. The big problem I see with all of this is basically nothing happened. They put a big target on their back. They're never, ever going to get hired again. Like, she's not going to go work for Twitter, and Meta owns Instagram, so I don't know what she's going to do. Uber basically tells you not to worry about the bad things they did in all of these different countries because they've changed how they operate now, and apparently governments are just cool with that. Nobody really cared. They went and talked to all these parliaments to try and get some laws enacted to protect people. The companies themselves didn't change their operations very much at all. I mean, Uber still will send their own employees to counter-protest taxi cab companies that are protesting Uber moving into their, you know, into their part of business, and nobody really does anything about it. So my big question at the end of all this research was it really worth it for these people to basically blacklist themselves from the industry they spent a career in to try and enact change that the governments that we have don't really care about? You know, on the flip side, I can't say that they operated very well either. Neither of them, the Uber files in particular, he was effective leaking things before his name was ever out there. He didn't ever need to come forward, but chose to. And frankly, I think the reason is so he could become a public figure and start selling books on the matter, which, in my opinion, kind of brings its own moral dilemma to it. Like, you felt it was a big ethical concern, so you decided to start leaking information on it, but also you wanted to make money on it. So did you really care in the first place, or did you just see the opportunity to get a story? I guess my point with this is a lot of people will become a whistleblower, and I'm not sure it's ever worth it because nothing really changes. And on the other hand, I guess it's a good way to make money. And I guess that's basically all I got for tonight. So thank you.
Thanks, Michael. That was great. Yeah, brought up a lot of good points and concerns. So thank you. Does anybody have any questions for Michael? Comments? No? Okay. Ayana, are you ready?
Yes, I am ready.
All right, take it away.
All right, 1 second. Okay, so I'm doing my presentation on artificial intelligence versus machine learning. So AI is basically a digital computer or computer controlled robot. that performs tasks commonly associated with intelligent beings. It also encompasses the idea of a machine that can mimic human intelligence and has the ability to perceive, learn, reason, and solve problems. So the history of artificial intelligence starts between like 380 BC and the late 1600s. Various mathematicians, theologians, philosophers, professors, and authors muse about mechanical techniques, calculating machines, and numeral systems that all eventually led to the concept of mechanized human thought and non-human beings. In the early 1700s, depictions of all-knowing machines akin to computers were more widely discussed in popular literature. Jonathan Swift's novels, Gulliver Travels, mentioned a device called the engine, which is one of the earliest references to modern-day technology, specifically a computer. This device's intended purpose was to improve knowledge and mechanical operations to a point where even the least talented person was seen to be skilled. All of the senses and knowledge of a non-human mind, which is basically mimicking the artificial intelligence. In 1977, director George Lucas, with the film Star Wars, was released. The film featured C-3PO, a humanoid robot who was designed as a protocol droid and is fluent in more than 7 million forms of communication and has a companion, R2-D2, which is a small astromech droid who is incapable of human speech, which is the inverse of C-3PO, but instead R2-D2 communicates with electronic beeps. Its function includes small repairs and co-piloting starfighters. In 1998, Dave Hampton and Caleb Chung invented Furby. This was the first pet toy robot for children. And then in 1999, in line with Furby, Sony introduced AIBO, which is Artificial Intelligence Robot, a 2000 robotic pet dog crafted to learn by interacting with its environment, owners, and other AIBOs. Its features include the ability to understand and respond to 100-plus voice commands and communicate with its human owner. In 2004, the sci-fi film iRobot, directed by Alex Proyas, is released. The set year was in 2035, and humanoid robots serve humankind, while one individual, vehemently anti-robot, given the outcome of a personal tragedy, which is determined by a robot. In 2011, Apple released a Siri, a virtual assistant on Apple iOS operating system. Siri uses a natural language user interface to infer, observe, answer, and recommend things to its human user. It adapts the voice commands and projects as an individualized experience per user. And then in 2016, a humanoid robot named Sophia was created by Hanson Robotics. She is known as the first robot citizen, and what distinguish Sophia from previous humanoids is her likeness to an actual human being, with her ability to see, image recognition, make facial expressions, and communicate through AI. So what is machine learning? Basically, machine learning is a subset of artificial intelligence that automatically enables a machine or system to learn and improve from experience. Machine learning also uses algorithms to analyze large amount of data, learn from the insights, and then make informed decisions. It also improves performance over time as they are trained, and the machine learning models are the output of what the program learns from running on an algorithm on training data. The history of machine learning starts with Arthur Samuel of IBM developed a computer program for playing checkers in the 1950s. The program had a very small amount of computer memory available, and Samuel initiated what is called the alpha-beta pruning. The design included a scoring function used using the position of the pieces on the board, and then the scoring function attempted to measure the chances of each side winning. The program chooses its next move using a Minimax strategy, which eventually evolved into the Minimax algorithm. Samuel also designed a number of mechanisms allowing his program to become even better. And what Samuel called root learning, his program recorded, remembered all positions it had already seen and combined this with the value of the reward function. Arthur Samuel coined the phrase machine learning in 1952. In 1957, Frank Rosenblatt, as the Cornell Aeronautical Laboratory, combined Donald Hebb's model of brain cells interactions with Arthur Samuel's machine learning efforts and created the perceptron. The perceptron was initially planned as a machine, not a program. So the software originally designed for an IBM 704 was installed in a custom-built machine called the Mark I perceptron, which had been constructed for image recognition. This made the software and the algorithms transferable and available for other machines. The nearest neighborhood algorithm came about in 1967, and it was the beginning of basic pattern recognition. This algorithm was used for mapping routes and was one of the earliest algorithms used in finding a solution to the traveling salesperson problem or finding the most efficient route. Using it, a salesperson enters a selected city and repeatedly has a program visit the nearest cities until all the cities have been visited. Marcello Pelio has been given the credit for inventing the nearest neighbor rule. He in turn credits the famous Culver and Hat paper of 1965. Oops. So in the late 1970s and early 1980s, artificial intelligence research focused on using logical knowledge-based approaches rather than algorithms. Additionally, neural network research was abandoned by computer science and AI researchers. This caused a schism between artificial intelligence and machine learning. But until then, machine learning had been used for a training program for AI. In 1990 became about boosting, and boosting was a necessary development for the evolution of machine learning. The boosting algorithms are used to reduce biases during supervised learning and include machine learning algorithms that transform weak learners into strong ones. The concept of boosting was first presented in 1990, paper titled The Strength of Weakness Learnability by Robert Shapir. So Shapir said that a set of weak learners can create a single strong learner, and weak learners are defined as classifiers that are only slightly correlated with the true classification, which is better than random guessing. By contrast, a strong learner is easily classified and well aligned with the true classification. So currently much of speech recognition training is done by deep learning technique called long short-term memory, and it's a neural network model described by Jürgen Schmidt-Huber and Sepp Hochreiter in 1997. The LSTM can learn tasks that require memory of events that took place thousands of discrete steps earlier, which is quite important for speech. Around the year 2007, long short-term memory started outperforming more traditional speech recognition programs. And then in 2015, the Google speech recognition program reportedly had a significant performance jump of 49% using a CTC-trained LSTM. And so in 2006, facial recognition became reality. The Facial Recognition Grand Challenge was a National Institute of Standards and Technology program that evaluated the popular face recognition algorithms of all time. 3D face scans, iris images, and high-resolution face images were tested, and their findings suggested the new algorithms were 10 times more accurate than the facial recognition algorithm from 2011 and 100 times more accurate than those from 1995. Some of those algorithms were able to outperform human participants in recognizing faces and uniquely identify identical twins. In 2012, Google X Lab developed a machine learning algorithm that can autonomously browse and find videos containing cats. In 2014, Facebook developed a deepfake, an algorithm capable of recognizing or verifying individuals in a photograph with the same accuracy as humans. Machine learning at its present moment is now responsible for some of the most significant advances in technology. It is being used for the new industry of self-driving vehicles and for exploring the galaxy as it helps in identify exoplanets. Recently, machine learning was defined by Stanford University as a science of getting computers to act without being explicitly programmed. Machine learning has prompted a new array of concepts and technologies, including supervised and unsupervised learning, new algorithms for robots, and the Internet of Things, the analytic tools, chatbots, and more. So the differences between AI and machine learning is that AI allows a machine to simulate human intelligence to solve problems, while machine learning allows a machine to learn autonomously from past data. The goal for AI is to develop an intelligent system that can perform complex tasks, and the goal for machine learning is to build machines that can learn from data to increase the accuracy of the output. So AI is able to build systems that can solve complex tasks like humans, but machine learning has a limited scope of applications. AI uses technology to systems so that it mimics human decision-making, while machine learning uses self-learning algorithms to produce predictive models. AI works with all types of data, structured, semi-structured, and unstructured. While machine learning can only use structured and semi-structured data. AI systems use logic and decision trees to learn reasons and self-correct. So the connection between AI and machine learning is that AI is a broader concept of enabling a machine or system to sense, reason, act, or adapt like humans. Machine learning is the application of AI that allows machines to extract knowledge from data and learn from it autonomously. So there's four types of artificial intelligence. The first one is reactive memory. Reactive memories are AI systems that have no memory and are task specific, meaning that an input always delivers the same output. The next type of AI in its evolution is limited memory. This algorithm imitates the way our brains, neurons work together, meaning that it gets smarter as it receives more data to train on. The first two types of AI, reactive machine and limited memory, are types that currently exist. Theory of mind and self-awareness are AI types that will be built in the future. The grand finale for the evolution of AI would be to design systems that have a sense self, a conscious understanding of their existence, but this type of AI does not exist yet. And the four types of machine learning, the first one is supervised. Supervised learning, the machine is taught by example. The operator provides a machine learning algorithm with the known data set that includes desired inputs and outputs. And the algorithm must find a method to determine how to arrive at those inputs and outputs. While the operator knows the correct answer to the problem, the algorithm identifies patterns in data, learn from observations, and make predictions. The algorithm makes predictions and is corrected by the operator, and this process continues until algorithms achieve a high level of accuracy and performance. Semi-supervised learning is similar to supervised learning, but instead it uses labels and unlabeled data. Labeled data is essentially information that has meaningful tags so that the algorithm can use the data, while unlabeled data lacks information. By using this combination, machine learning algorithms can learn to label and unlabel data. Unsupervised is a machine learning algorithm studies data to identify patterns. there is no answer key or human operator to provide instruction, but instead the machine determines the correlations and relationship by analyzing available data. In an unsupervised learning process, the machine learning algorithm is left to interpret large data sets and address the data accordingly. The algorithm tries to organize that data in some way to describe the structure. This might mean grouping the data into clusters or arranging it in a way that looks more organized. Reinforcements focuses on regimented learning processes where a machine learning algorithm is provided with the set actions, parameters, and values. By defining the rules, the machine learning algorithm then tries to explore different options and possibilities, monitoring and evaluating each result to determine which one is optimal. Reinforcement learning teaches the machine trial and error. It learns from the past experience and begins to adapt to its approaches and responds to the situation to achieve the best possible results. So some examples of artificial intelligence that I've recently seen is the new feature on Snapchat, which is My AI. And I actually use My AI sometimes. My AI is Lola. And you can have like conversations or ask questions. It's basically just a friendly interaction between you and AI, opposed to like when you are online shopping and you're trying to resolve something and they put you through an AI bot, or you're on the phone, they got you with a machine operator. I've heard about OpenAI ChatGPT, but I really never further investigated in it. But from what I've heard is that it can do anything, like write papers and like do resumes. And it was a very popular topic because I know students were getting caught with it, because I guess professors would run their paper to see if it was artificially written or if it was written by a human. So that's pretty much all I know about that. With machine learning, I think people get confused with machine learning and artificial intelligence, even though machine learning is a subset of machine learning. But here's an example of machine learning. We have younger Michael Jackson singing an older Michael Jackson song. So I look at that.
Oh, we can't hear it.
Oh, what happened?
Did you forget to share with audio?
Share audio?
When you go to share content, next to that is include computer sound, and you have to toggle that on.
Where?
Okay, so stop sharing.
Uh-huh.
And then click the share button again.
Okay.
And then next to share content, it says include computer sound, and you toggle that on.
Okay. I have no idea if it's sharing or not.
Oops, it isn't sharing yet. So you have to do share with computer sound and then choose your screen.
Oh, cool. So this was the, hopefully it plays back.
Yep, we can hear it.
So that's what machine learning does. It could do voice manipulation. I've seen other things with machine learning where there's one person and then a celebrity and the real person is talking, but it sounds like the actual celebrity. So that's interesting. And as far as like algorithms and stuff, so all your likes, your tweets, your retweets, your favorites, that all gets stored. And that basically depicts the type of content that you are going to see. And that also depicts the type of content that like that creator is going to see, well, is going to put out. And that's based off of all the stored data that people are interested in. The pros and cons of AI. So the pros is that the execution of tasks by humans is more prone to make errors. So we often make mistakes while doing specific tasks, and this might be due to the variations of intellectual ability of an individual. But it's not the same case with AI-based machine. The machine is programmed for in a way to accomplish a specific task. Thus, the accuracy depends on how well the AI is designed and programmed for the machine to carry out the task. And also, unlike humans, machines do not require breaks to recover from tiredness and boost productivity. There are many day-to-day tasks accomplished by humans, which are repetitive. The efficiency of a human reduces while continuously performing the same job. Moreover, it is the fact that a human worker can be productive for only 8 to 10 hours per day, but on an average worker can only invest in service for 7 to 8 hours a day. Humans need time to refresh themselves. They need to maintain work life, and they cannot work 24 hours a day. Another advantage of artificial intelligence is the ability to make the right decisions. There are no emotions attached to the AI-based machines that help prevent hampering efficiency. The machines that are built using artificial intelligence are capable of making logical decisions as well. A human would examine a situation by considering many factors, and these factors may influence the decisions emotionally or practically. However, the machine gives accurate results as they are programmed to make logical decisions. AI-powered machines use a cognitive computing that helps them make practical decisions in real time. The cons of artificial intelligence is the creation of machines empowered with artificial intelligence is very costly. For a large-scale project, the price might reach up to millions of dollars, and for a small-scale project, it's not possible to implement AI. For companies with large revenues, too, the cost of the development of an AI project may be felt high due to the features, functionalities, or scope with which it is designed. The cost of development also depends on the hardware and the software the companies use. In the not-so-distant future, the rapid advancements of artificial intelligence has brought about unprecedented levels of automation, leading to profound impact on a global workforce. While AI has undoubtedly revolutionized various industries, there is an unmistakable human toll associated with its progress. And lastly, machines cannot become as creative as humans. Artificial intelligence can provide functionalities to learn from data, but cannot make the machine mimic the exact human brain and skills. The accuracy of the results from AI-powered machines depends on the level of analytics used by the creator. Artificial intelligence cannot invent anything, and it can just perform the task it's programmed for and improve itself by experience. The pros and cons of machine learning. The pros of machine learning is that it can review large volumes of data that discovers specific trends and patterns that would not be apparent to humans. For instance, for an e-commerce website like Amazon, it starts to understand the browsing behaviors and purchase histories of its users to help cater to the right products, deals, and reminders relevant to them. It uses results to reveal relevant advertisements as well. With machine learning, you don't have to babysit your project every step of the way, and since it means giving machine the ability to learn, it lets them make predictions and also improve the algorithm on their own. A common example of this is the antivirus software. They learn to filter new threats as they are recognized, and then machine learning is also good at recognizing spam. As machine learning gains experience, they keep improving in accuracy and efficiency. This lets them make better decisions, and say you need to make a weather forecast model. As the amount of data you have keep growing, your algorithm learns to make more accurate predictions faster. The cons of machine learning is that machine learning requires massive data sets to train on, and these should be exclusive, unbiased, and of good quality. There can also be times where they must wait for new data to be generated. Machine learning needs enough time to let the algorithm learn and develop enough to fulfill their purpose with a considerable amount of accuracy and relevancy. It also needs massive resources to function. This can be an additional requirements of computer power view from you. Another major challenge is the ability to accurately interpret results generated by the algorithms. You must be careful. You must also carefully choose the algorithm for your purpose. My opinion on artificial intelligence and machine learning overall is that it has, I feel like it can be good, but I feel like it may be also used for bad. And when I say bad, I mean to the point where humans are too dependable on AI and they forget or don't know how to do basic human functions. And so that is all I have. Any thoughts or questions?
Wow, that was great. Very good.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you go back and read the chat, we were very engaged. Does anybody have any thoughts or questions for
Alan? I have a question. In your research, one of the subsets of machine learning is deep learning.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the options of that? Because it's attempt to mimic the neuronal processes.
Right. So I've actually did some research on extensive research on deep learning 3 years ago, because this was the first time I was introduced to machine learning, and at the time I didn't even know that it existed. But there's also other branches aside from deep learning. I forgot the other branches, but deep learning is probably one of the top methods that is used when it comes to machine learning. And so that's what I got from it.
Yeah, because the whole idea behind deep learning is that you're going to mimic the neurons of the brain. And so it does the reinforcement training. It is all the things that the other machine learning programs use, but it's not dependent upon statistics.
Right.
And that's the real big difference. And so I was, wondering if we're going to finally develop the terial cell. Which is the cell of artificial intelligence, if you didn't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't know that. Wow. Wow.
Why aren't you in analytics?
Ayana, you stay in soft dev. Yeah, you can. I mean, you can do cross things if you're interested in analytics.
I may take a peek at it.
But we'd keep you in soft dev still.
Yeah. Okay, let me stop sharing my screen.
Matthew, go ahead. I saw your hand raised, Matthew.
Sorry. I hit mute instead of unmute.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
I shared a link for 2-minute neuroscience videos. They're real quick ways to get you a little bit more insight into how our current understanding of neuroscience works. And that's a lot of the basis on where deep learning and different algorithms may go into that they've built neurons and everything out of.
Right. They're using all the propagation of the signal along the membrane. But if they can just figure out how to do the neuropeptide stuff, we might actually have a better solution.
Capsules.
Yeah, it is scary what we could be capable of. But like somebody said in chat, we're nowhere near that, thankfully. All right. Were there any other comments or questions? No? Bradley wasn't able to make it, but he did. He was able to do his presentation here. So let me go ahead and play that.
Oh. Hello, everyone, and welcome to my masterclass presentation on digital ownership. What is digital ownership? Digital ownership is the thought process of what control you have over your digital purchases. Do you actually own a digital purchase? Can it be taken from you without warning? And if a site does stop allowing you to access it, do you get a refund? And for media, we're talking about digital ownership. It's like movies that you buy from Amazon and store on their cloud server, or video games you download from Steam but don't keep on your computer. Even the same thing with music that you download. Understanding digital ownership. What rights do you have as a purchaser of digital media? Digital versus traditional ownership rights vary greatly. A traditional ownership right, everyone I'm sure remembers, maybe not everyone now, but VHS movies used to have the FBI warnings about distributing and all that. It's some of the ownership rights of physical media. Digital media has other rights, like you may only get five downloads of this, or you cannot play it at more than one location at a time. And so really, you need to understand your ownership rights with the media you purchase. And to start to understand that, you need to understand the difference between licensing and ownership. Licensing is like leasing your car, but with a big caveat. It's more accurate to say is you are paying a one-time purchase to drive someone else's lease car whenever you want. However, that person or even the dealership can take that car back at a moment's notice, and you are just out that money. All of this is spelled out in those terms of services and end user license agreements that everyone signs and hardly reads, because we all know they're 20 to some hundred pages and hard to understand. End user license agreement specifically is what you, the purchaser, are. You're an end user of that licensing agreement. The agreement's between two other people or corporations, and you are the end user. There are limitations of digital ownership. Digital Rights Management, DRM, is the right you have to your media, specifically your digital media, and how you manage them. So terms and services, it's similar to that. It's just more specific to your digital rights. There's geographical limitations. As everyone knows, I'm sure they've seen YouTube ad for VPNs, that you can only watch certain shows in certain areas because of the licensing agreements. It even can go so as far as other countries have different media restrictions of what is appropriate content. And so they won't allow you to watch it because they deem it inappropriate or it needs to be edited for their viewership. And also, limitations is on the platform, where you can watch something on Netflix, but you can't watch it on Hulu. Or I buy something, a digital movie, on my PlayStation, but I cannot watch it on my Xbox, even though it's the same format and everything. They just don't transfer between the two. And most of these rights can be changed, and limitations can be changed at any moment. Licensing agreements can be terminated. They can be changed. It's really a conversation that is happening between these two corporations that affects you, but you have no say in it. The impact on ownership rights. Platforms can change or shut down at any time. Just as I was previously stating, these are conversations that are happening without you. HBO is a big deal with that right now, as they were purging their media library. A lot of shows are just no longer watchable through any legal means. And this actually affects a lot of creators because it was part of their portfolio, and now they can't even show it off with any legal means, they would have to illegally get a copy of it to show us, like, I did create this. I was a part of this. Even downloads can be discontinued. Amazon does this all the time, where you buy a digital movie from them where you can download and watch wherever you want, but then they lose the licensing agreement and you go to play it maybe a year later, maybe two, and they're like, sorry, you can't no longer watch this. We just don't have it anymore, even though you paid for it, and you're just out of luck. Even your own digital copy could get deleted if you digitally download it. It does take up a lot of space. If it gets accidentally deleted, there may not be resources for you to download it a second time. And so you're just out of luck. It's basically accidentally deleting a file would be considered throwing out a VHS or having the tape inside rip or scratch on the DVD. It's just gone, and you aren't going to get a refund for that. There are ownership alternatives to digital media. Downloading for off-use is still digital media, but you have to have a place to store it. I know people who have external hard drives specifically for that, where they download their media to, and so it keeps their computer free of all of it. It's saved in one spot. It's also one place to lose them if something ever happens. But that is, it's actually turning that digital into a physical copy. They still do make physical copies of most media. You can't say all, because some TV shows and stuff like that, once that DVD boom was over, stopped making season DVDs and such. So some of those shows are just lost to the ages if you can't stream them or download them. It also brings us to the issue of piracy. Media piracy was primarily because of availability and access. Piracy went down when streaming started because Netflix, the big one in the beginning, pretty much had everything. And people were like, well, I don't need to search for something I want and steal it versus, oh, this is convenient and there. Or the show I want to watch is on now when I want it versus waiting. It's like, well, I got to watch 10 episodes of Seinfeld before The Office is on TBS. And so, it's an example. And so, those are coming alternative to digital media. There's also many advantages of digital ownership. It's very convenient. You can download a movie whenever you want, as long as it's on the website. You can also play it on almost any device, depending on where you download it from. There's multiple options, usually. And that makes it instant per your internet speed. If you have nice fiber gigabyte internet, downloading a movie in high definition shouldn't be that difficult, and it should happen fairly quickly. It's also just a physical space reduction. For those who remember having bookshelves full of VHS tapes or DVDs or even CD towers, it's not needed anymore because all the media is kept in the cloud or on tiny devices. And because of this, it can be taken almost anywhere. Nowadays, phones are essentially TVs and can stream almost any information you want at any time. There's even portable game devices now, Steam Deck, the Switch, and many third-party options where you can play your games handheld on the go. So some tips for maximizing your digital ownership. I know it's a pain in the butt and can be hard to do, but you really should read your terms of services and end user license agreement. This will detail out what you actually own of the media. It will state out how long a notice you have to be given if they're removing your media, or if you get a refund. Some places will refund you 100% if it's under a month and it goes away. Some places will give you diminishing returns on it. It's like if you had it for 3 months, no refund. Or if you had it for 2 months, you'll get half a refund. And if you can look for digital right management free or download options where someone else isn't managing your rights, you directly own this. That still being said, websites can shut down, ownership can change, all of that can happen. So it's up to everyone to understand what their actual rights are with what they purchase. And this is the section I have for questions, but if you're playing this recording, it means I wasn't able to make class tonight.
Okay, I think I stopped sharing too soon, but yeah, that was a great presentation. Brought up a lot of good points. Does anybody have any comments, questions? Let me look at chat.
Yeah, a little comment. Okay. Back to the issue or the example of the vehicle here in the beginning of the presentation where I've recently heard of a motorcycle company that manufacture electric motorcycles, but the thing is that they already include some of the features like heated handlebars or upgraded this or that. However, you have to pay for those upgrades, which begs the question, like, do you actually own it? Can they take it away at any point after you've already purchased it? Where do your rights as the person spending $30,000 on a vehicle, where do your rights lie in that? So it's kind of, I feel like kind of the same thing. And it's interesting and a scary thought to bring up.
Right. Yep. Yeah, with software, all the vehicles and, mechanical things, they're all run on software. My husband has to go in all the time with his semi and get the updates for the software to run his truck. So... if that company goes out of business? What if what are his rights as a purchaser and user?
So, or yeah. Are you allowed to remove certain things on your own vehicle that you own?
Right. Because if it gets repossessed,
mm-hmm.
If you're making payments and it gets repossessed, yeah. I know that it voids warranty if you chip out your diesel trucks. like Ford, Dodge, whatever.
Yeah. And also, it comes, what about privacy, privacy rights and, things like that. And like, what kind of rights do you have for your privacy on, those kinds of purchases?
Right. Yep.
Something fun.
Yeah.
Scary.
Yeah. I didn't know that about Amazon because I purchase movies. No, I guess that's YouTube. I pay monthly for YouTube, so I don't have to watch all the ads and stuff. But I do purchase movies off of there, but I don't know how long they'll be there.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Does anybody else have any questions, comments? Landon, I saw you unmuted. Did you have anything?
Oh, no, I was just going to say, they could even take your stuff that you digitized yourself.
Oh, really? Yeah.
Yeah, all my A-tracks and cassettes I converted to digital, and they disappeared one day.
Wow.
Wait, what?
Yep.
Who are they?
I have no idea. One day they were on my iTunes, and next day they were not. So I guess Apple. Is a guilty party.
That's different. You can't count Apple in anything. Store it on a non-Apple device, you'll be fine. You have the rights of the physical device, and you have the rights of a a backup, which is a digital copy. Apple probably screws around with that by quote unquote iTunes limitations.
Yeah, well, they're going to make sure we don't have rights to our hardware anymore.
Wow. But
I'm not going to go any further there.
Yeah, they just keep on shutting us down at every turn, it seems. As far as the external hard drive goes, my brother, he had all his wedding photos and the kids when they were young on his external hard drive. Something happened and it broke or something, and he lost all that data. So now he uses OneDrive or no, Dropbox. But, you know, there too, do you own those pictures now because you're using somebody's third party software, or somebody else's software rather?
Back up your backups.
Yeah. When I was going through school, I had three. I would do it to my OneDrive, copy it to my OneDrive, my external drive, and my hard drive.
And your drive that you have in a secure location many, 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 many miles away.
Yeah. All right. Great topics tonight. Thank you, everybody. Thanks to our presenters, Michael, Ayana, and Bradley. And if there's nothing else, I think we can call it good. All right. Have a good night, everyone.
Have a good night.
All right. See you guys.
Good night.
All right. Take care.